back with episode 777 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Lucky Gary. How's it going tonight?
That's right. Hopefully we will continue to have great luck with this particular episode. And we are going to be getting into the rest of our episodic discussion for this week. And boy, we have quite a few good episodes this time, so we'll see if we get into a little bit of discussion about other things as well. But first, before we do any of that, Gary, if you could give us a disclaimer.
Yes, we will unabashedly spoil you. If you have not watched these shows or heard what happens in them, this might not be the episode for you. However, I encourage you to listen on and be hopelessly spoiled by every intricacy that we reveal over the next show.
That's right. And we are going to be getting into a few shows here in a little bit of detail. Most assuredly, our top three. And, well, let's go ahead and start right off with our number three show, which is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 4, Episode 11, Wake Up. May searches for the truth about what happened to her, and Ada plans a desperate move that could put everyone in danger. And this episode came in at an average of 8.33, so a bit above average there. And Edmund actually left us some comments on this one, saying, interesting to see May's defiance shine through in both the original and the LMD versions. The pincer movement between Radcliffe and the Senators is sowing discord and boxing the team in nicely. Yeah, I really have to say that the twists and turns with the LMDs is getting really nice and intricate here, and a lot more complicated than I thought the writers were going to do. What do you think, Gary?
Oh, yeah, the substitution of May was a real winner for me. I figured they were just going to introduce a no-name character like Ada again, and you know she'd be gone, and there'd be no lasting repercussions to our core staff once this little miniseries runs its course. But I think there are several repercussions, both the just for May being a prisoner and having to deal with all this, the whole virtual reality thing, which is kind of interesting, which maybe they could spin off. And then the what are they calling it? Is it Phil May? I've heard the relationship ships referred to as a bunch of different ways. Mason,
Molson?
But Molson rather, yeah, Molson. But so
down smooth a little bit. Of the yeah. Kick.
So and then there's you know that repercussion to deal with. There's the even though Fitz was obviously doing the right call, the way he was misleading Jenna might have repercussions. So no, they're definitely you know loading our characters with you know with a lot of. Detail from this thing that I think that'll carry with them through further episodes. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I have to say that they got me in this one. They sure did. They, you know, the whole May escaping. I fell for it hook, line, and sinker. I bought it all the way up to the I think when she got up to that other room area and Ada appeared again. Then I figured something was up. But they had me going for the first few minutes. Did you get suckered in, John?
Oh, definitely. I'm not even going to lie. Not only that. But I would say there was that scene between Fitz and Radcliffe. And when Fitz turns around and shoots him in the head, I was just like, my eyes went wide. I was like, whoa, they didn't just... And then when he turned out to be an LMD, I said, wow, they are really committing to this. This is a lot more complicated than I thought it was going to be. So I was quite impressed with how much they are complicating this little arc that they're doing. Yeah. Because I really felt like it was going to be all about Ada, much like you said. With maybe a little bit more about May, because they've been focusing on that. I did not see the Radcliffe thing coming at all, nor did I see this whole thing of him and the Senator working together, because that ties back to the Ghost Rider arc really well.
Yeah, they're obviously not forgetting details, and they're you know they're holding some of these and pulling them back out when we least expect them. And I you know as a side note about the Senator, I enjoy that type of villain versus say the Watch Dogs was it? I think it's a much more effective and appropriate villain for S.H.I.E.L.D. to have to just come out guns blazing. I don't think is necessarily always the right thing. While Nick Fury has well been known for you know battling Hydra forces en masse, the idea that it's a little bit more of a thinking man's war seems to appeal to me for S.H.I.E.L.D. for some reason that I can't quite explain. It just seems a better fit.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a topicality going there too between the whole idea that there is you know a government official that has definitely certain bigoted opinions, shall we say. And then fostering and fueling this Watchdogs militia that's out there, because they are all interconnected. But yeah, you're right. When it comes to S.H.I.E.L.D. themselves, going up against the Watchdogs feels a little bit out of touch. where I think that they're just trying to make sure that they have someone to fight in, that isn't Hydra. They don't have Hydra anymore. They have to have some kind of people that they can beat up on a regular basis, where the politics is something that is really hard for them to navigate and always has been. So that's a nice way of continuing to show that. The other thing that I guess the only thing that really held this back just a little bit for me, or I would have given it a little bit more, Talbot continues to be way over the top. Almost to the point of not even really fitting the rest of the show at this point. Because you have a guy like Director Mace, and they've given him so much nuance. The conversation between him and Daisy, for instance, was really good in this episode. In terms of, you know, just him really kind of letting out some of his inner psychology to her. That was really nice. And then right after that, you have someone like Talbot walk in the door who is a walking, talking caricature. And it just doesn't fit for me. I mean, the actor's doing what he can with it, but it just feels...
So you think it's the script or the actor?
I think it's the way that they write the character is over the top, and then the actor is putting... the lines that he's being given are completely over the top. And I think that he's trying to tread a line. Maybe it is some of the actor, but it seems to me a mixture of the two. Because there are times where it feels like he's like, where it almost feels like, even in this episode, he'll kind of drop the act a little bit with Phil and be like, you know, and show that he isn't that big blustery guy, but he so often is. And I don't really know why. I don't know if that's where they started the character at and they feel like they have to just let him continue to go that way. But he walks in the door and it's like something happens. The chemistry just doesn't work.
Well, you know, the basis of the character is exactly that. In the comic books, at least for many decades, he was, you know, he worked for Thunderbolt Ross to go after the Hulk. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of, you know, that blind, almost crazy, screaming guy that is portrayed in S.H.I.E.L.D., where he's like, go get him, we got to go. It was, you know, gung-ho, gung-ho, gung-ho. And maybe they're taking a little bit of that to heart too much. But I've always felt that it was the acting that really pushed it over the edge, that maybe they might have been running to that and the actor himself just decided to go for it.
Well, then what I would expect is that the director would maybe find a way to bring it in a little bit, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And they don't, so it's kind of like, okay, is he supposed to be that way or what? But I don't know. He was one of the things that was just in the back of my mind. I was like, wow, there was so much working for this episode that it felt really out of place, even more so than usual, because everything else was working so well. I don't know. Anything else in particular about this episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I feel like we've hit on just about everything. I still don't understand Coulson getting caught in the office. That seems like such a rookie thing. Mm. I'm surprised, and secondly, I'm surprised that that it was a whole setup by the senator to begin with. Who do they have in S.H.I.E.L.D. to reveal something like that? Because that's what it feels like. Well, maybe May.
What I understood was that it was basically May and Radcliffe. In a chain, because remember, Radcliffe is also an LMD, so, you know, May was also, I believe they made a pretty good point of saying that she doesn't even realize she's doing these things against the rest of the team, because she can't even tell them what she's doing, because it's against her programming. So
yes.
I think they kind of alluded to the fact that, yes, it's not as simple as there just being one mole or one thing. They've just been infiltrated completely. And now that they've gotten rid of Radcliffe, they're going to assume, okay, that was the problem. And they're not even going to think to look for May at this point. So, yeah, it sounds like it's really going to continue to be pretty complicated and, quite frankly, really looking forward to it. So, let's see here. One moment. There we go. Okay, so next on our list in the number 2 position, we have Timeless, Season 1, Episode 12, The Murder of Jesse James. Flynn joins forces with legendary outlaw Jesse James, and the two create bloody havoc across the American frontier. Fun. This episode got an 8.5, which, again, you know, Timeless is doing pretty well right now. I think it was, yes, it was in our top three last week as well. So, came back with two episodes that were towards the top of our list. Gary, I know you're a pretty big fan of the show, and you also gave this a pretty high score.
I did. You know, in our ranking system, I gave it a 9. It had, it wasn't without it some of its flaws. I think the back at headquarters or base, the whole second driver with, is it Gia?
Jaya.
Yeah. I don't see where it's going with that, but, because we sort of seemed to get the information that she was trying to sneak and get anyway. So that seemed a little bit of an excess story snippet for me. But, you know, we have a bunch of different things. We have the little historical nugget that that was in with the Lone Ranger and Tonto, which that was a hilarious scene when they're talking about the Lone Ranger. And then, you know, they see his companion who's part Indian, and they go, "Tonto, they're calling me stupid in Spanish."
I see what you're saying. I understand Spanish.
Yeah, that was really funny. So I enjoyed that little bit. And yeah, and once again, I think, you know, just as they did last week with Houdini, they captured the you know, historical aspect. Well, can't say I know enough about this particular one to say how accurate it was. It was definitely a highlight and an addition to the story that was well played. So that being said, we had to deal with Lucy actually, you know, shooting Jesse James, and she did it because I'm assuming she knows that's what the timeline is supposed to be. And at the same time, you know, she had to, you know, had to deal with it as the Lone Ranger character, Connor, I think was his name, you know, had to say, you know, he had no weapons and he was surrendering and you still shot him. You know, you have to live with that. That's wrong. You know, and, you know, he was very, very much on the moral high ground, and rightly so. And mm-hmm. I think she realized that as well, that, you know, much as even though Jesse James was having the conversation with Flynn about your cause turning sort of in, you know, losing its maybe its romanticism or its pure, pure cause, or its pureness about it, you know, we actually saw that play out, I think, for Lucy. She's so distraught still over her sister, feeling like she, or daughter rather, daughter. Was her daughter disappeared? Yeah, daughter. Sister.
Her sister.
Yeah. Her sister disappearing through time. And she was very disturbed by that in this episode. And, you know, and so I think, you know, even though we heard Flynn and Jesse James talk about it, we actually got to watch Lucy go through it. mm-hmm. You know, she's starting to wonder where the, you know, where the line is. And even Rufus and Wyatt are sort of discussing the same thing about, you know, when did killing become so casual to us? You know, and yeah. You know, how can we be, you know, how can we be the people trying to write things yet we're killing people all the time? It's you know, it's a very odd dichotomy. And I thought some of the questions they brought up, well, I can't say they answered them. They were definitely very thought-provoking and gave a depth to this episode that sometimes I don't think they always have. So that was really nice. I like that whole aspect a lot.
I want to touch on that real quick.
Oh, go ahead.
If you don't mind.
Yeah. Oh, no, go for it.
I think even one of the characters, it might have been the Lone Ranger guy, said, who the hell ever said easy and right were the same thing? And that's the theme of the episode, I thought, and where they're really going lately, and I think that's why the show is doing better, is, as you said, everybody now, the main characters, have all essentially murdered somebody in the name of doing the right thing. They're becoming more and more like Flynn. And I really find that interesting, and it would really be sad if they don't get to play with that even more. I want to see them play with that idea of who's the good guy in all of this. What are we being forced to do in the name of quote-unquote protecting history? And they're not even doing a great job of it because they've changed history before. So it's like, yeah, this is becoming a lot more complicated than originally they were playing with in earlier episodes. And I think that's one of the things I really like, is this whole moral ambiguity that is now at the heart of the show. So go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And just as we had talked about, or at least I had talked about in previous shows, how, you know, is Flynn the villain? And now I have to wonder, is our crew the heroes? At this point, it's really getting, it is turning moral roles on its side. And The more I start thinking about, as we're getting into grayer and grayer areas, and we still have not really seen who is at the heart of Rittenhouse, it will not surprise me if one of our team members, yeah. And my personal money's on Rufus, is the founder of that whole thing.
Yeah, he is really starting to show some questionable behavior and choices here.
Yeah. So my guess is it is one of our three people. I still don't want to think it's Lucy, but it's somebody. I'm still guessing it's somebody that's in our main team that turns. But I can only hope for season renewal after season renewal to find that out. So
yeah. Well, that's the trick, right? Because yes. That is the kind of elephant in the room with this show is that it is not doing well in the ratings.
Yes.
And there is a lot of speculation that it's pretty much going to be a one-and-done season.
Oh, and I'm sorry for that because I know they won't be able to wrap it up in time. And yeah. But that being said, as I look at other shows over the years that sort of try to cover, do this kind of historical event kind of thing, this show is doing it so well. They're coming up with good reasons for going there. They're portraying I don't want to say heroes, but historical figures, if in a very believable light and not necessarily as, these gods up on pedestals. They seem to be doing it very well. And again, as I said, both in for both groups of, both for Jesse James and the Lone Ranger, they did a wonderful job portraying them. I really felt, it really felt like they were real people. They weren't just, jingoistic echoes of the one paragraph you get in your U.S. history book. So, it was really a lot of, was really enjoyable. Now, I don't know enough about the Lone Ranger legends, if they're actually was a real person that existed that was that, but the idea to make him African-American was genius. It seemed to work extremely well. It helped define some of his outlaw status and things like, and why, he was a Lone Ranger and not working with others, with other Rangers. It made a lot of sense. It worked. It seemed to fit very well. And I have to give him kudos. While I don't always necessarily like them changing up race or gender on some long existing characters, in this instance, I felt they pulled it off very well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and again, second week in a row that it's up at the top three, and I think well-deserved. It's going to be sad to see if this becomes a show that improved so much over its initial difficulties, only to falter in the ratings and kind of fall victim to that. I don't know that the next show has any such problems, because it seems to be getting a lot of support from Disney, of course, with the with its ties to the franchise. Star Wars Rebels, Season 3, Episode 15, Trials of the Darksaber. Sabine reluctantly agrees to learn to wield an ancient Mandalorian weapon in order to recruit people to join the Rebels. And, yeah, man, this was one heck of an episode, coming in at an average of 9.25. And this was easily up among my favorites for the series, let alone the season. This was one of the best episodes I've seen them do.
Oh, yeah, this had a lot of good marks. I enjoyed the... Heck, I enjoyed just the saber story. It was such a nice little snippet. The first Mandalorian Jedi.
Yeah.
And then it was stolen from the Jedi Temple. Gosh, could I see that movie, please? I would love just to see that. And then how it rallied the whole planet of Mandalore together as under the leader that was holding that blade. And then to find out that it's Sabine's family that was that family, and that she could carry on the tradition and unite her planet against the Empire. Wow, what great themes to put out. It was just yeah. That was really just good. And then, was there anything you want to say about that? Because I thought that was just such a great depth of a story for a little cartoon.
Well, just the fact that, there were many people that were upset because the old canon, quote-unquote, air quotes, old canon, was wiped out. And it's like, okay, but then they, in a very short order, recast certain elements of that and revamp them to work with this universe now. And in the new canon, I think that they've done a nice job of kind of adding to the lore. And, in one line, you had Kanan say something about the war between the Jedi and the Mandalorians. And my eyes lit up and said, and more, please. I know that it's a little bit of, continuity wonk, but it doesn't matter. It was just intriguing as it gets. But it was in the middle of all this character conflict going on, and really good, juicy ones, too. I don't think we've seen this much out of Sabine in a long time. Even episodes where she's the star of the episode, so to speak, or ostensibly, this was a lot to get from her. And the fact that it's just really the first part, because next time around she's going to actually have to deal with the family that she was just telling us she really wants nothing to do with. And she feels forced into all of this, but that's where they're going. Yeah, that's some great stuff for, as you said, just a little Star Wars cartoon that started off as being a more kid-friendly version of Clone Wars.
Yeah.
Or spinoff of it. No, this is exactly what I was hoping for from this show. Because there's very little in here that one could call kid fare.
Oh, this gosh, no. This is drama.
Even nasty. I mean, there were times when you were like, I'm not sure they're not trying to hurt each other here. And all they're doing is training, and it's like, ooh, man, when things really happen next time where she has to take up this mantle, boy, is she gonna implode? What's gonna happen? It's fun stuff.
Oh, I know. When much as we want to joke around at the training scenes with Kanan, as you said, when she opened up that she's done it all for, done it for her family, for her planet, that she's had to basically exile herself because she had to, she had to save them from the Empire, even if they didn't want to save themselves. And it was, her breakdown, if you want to call it, that was tremendously moving. If that was in a movie, that would be the Oscar scene. that's how good I really thought it was. So, I'm trying to think if there's anything else that there was really, talk about, cause it pretty much was the episode. and we have had other episodes with Sabine before. I was thinking with the Mandalorian general, who's now tagging along with our group at the moment, when she was back in her actual home that Thrawn was in, but you never saw this side of her before, so that was it was nice to see a completely different side of the character. And they're carefully putting some of these in. I also think about Zed when it was revealed, about his home planet and things, and how he lost so much. And they keep giving these tragic sort of stories to all our characters, and I guess there's a lot of them. We saw Ezra's, now we saw Zed's, now we've seen Sabine, Kanan's, I guess we've had hints of, but we still haven't seen them yet. I'm just wondering, does every poor soul in the Rebel universe have a horror story with them?
Yeah, well, I mean, probably.
Yeah, you could be right. No, I'm not disagreeing with you. It's just, another tragedy.
It's one of those things where Rogue One did pretty much lay out there that the Rebellion just could not get on the same page with one another until the events of Rogue One took place. And all these different people with their tragic backstories, as you said, all of them trying to find a way to work together when they've got all of these things that are all these hang-ups that are getting in the way. This is the first episode since we got that information that it made sense within Rebels, because they were focusing so much on the we're one big happy family on the ship, and it's like, no, you're not. You act like it. But then something like this happens and the truth comes out, where you've got these things under the surface that have just been waiting to come out. And yeah, you're not all necessarily working for the same thing, because you're forcing somebody to do something they really don't want to do. And you're doing it for the quote-unquote greater good. Well, what's the consequence of that going to be? Like, is she going to come around and everything's going to be fine again? Or is that going to always stick in the back of her head that you made her do that?
Mm.
I think it's really interesting. I think I know which way it's going to go, because this is the more kid-friendly version. But even the fact that they went there, they didn't have to. They made the choice to go there. So I'm really happy that they did.
Yeah, but I agree with you. Given what this show is, I mean, she's not going to leave the group to go lead Mandalore forever. Realistically, I can't see that happening. But really, that would be the payoff to this to the storyline. But I don't think I can't imagine that we would ever see that. My guess is that general character they're going to keep around is going to end up somehow gathering people or something. But really, the ultimate payoff would be her leaving the group to go with them. So, but I'd miss Sabine.
Yes.
So we'll have to see, but yeah, geez, I just this one, it just really knocked me out of the park. And as you said, John, this is so far from the origin of the series. It's kind of surprising if you consider where it started. So,
mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right, well, then we can now look at the other episodes that came out this week and pick a few here just to talk about as we still have a little bit of time left as I'm looking here at our clock. What I'd like to go ahead and do is spend a little more time talking about Grimm, like we did last week. We had Season 6, Episode 3, Oh, Captain, My Captain. Adeline and Monroe do everything in their power to see that Nick's clever plan to get under Captain Renard's skin goes off beautifully. Oh, wow.
Well read. That's actually right? good.
Meanwhile, Eve and Rosalie are under the gun to get their spell ready on time. And yeah, I guess the reason I wanted to mention this is it's got an 8.25, so just out of the top three, is that, wow, for something that was essentially designed to hit the reset button, this was probably one of the smartest and best versions of that I've seen in a long time. Because, yeah, it did reset things, but it did so in a way that didn't negate any of what happened before. So.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
I was really quite impressed with this episode. It seemed like you liked it quite a bit, too.
I did, although I didn't consider... Yeah, I guess I'm so deep into the show, I never considered the reset aspect of this, what happened. But you're absolutely right. It kind of wiped the slate, and they're ready to recreate their show yet yet again. Renard's definitely sort of in check, I guess, for lack of a better term. So... And what we're talking about as they were talking about Renard's skin is they used the magic potion and that witch's hat to make Nick look like Renard and renounce the mayorship and reinstore everyone to their jobs and also have his butt kicked by a little girl. Again. <Yeah. laughs> So, that was interesting that Diana was able to negate the potion when they thought that he might be stuck looking like Renard forever. So I thought it was a little bit of a MacGuffin, but given that they constantly talk about her and her tremendous powers and her destiny and this and that, it's not like they don't wave the magic wand around enough to use it once in a while. Although I was disappointed that the stick didn't fix them.
Were you
picturing the stick?
I did at first. Yeah. I thought that the stick of truth was going to actually be the obvious name for it now. Yeah. I thought that was going to be the MacGuffin to get him back now, but I guess they had to go to the other uber powerful item on the list, which was Diana. Plus, that makes it a little bit juicier as far as the drama goes because of the whole Renard connection with Diana. So, it is. I was expecting the stick. We didn't get the stick. We got instead the demon child. And yeah, I still feel like that's a little bit of something that's hanging out there that it's like, guys, we really need to get something. They are trying to find reasons why the stick of truth is bad and don't use it. And why, with all these symbols and everything else that kind of point you towards a, this is not good type of situation, but they haven't really gone there yet to explain how that's going to limit the power. And you've got two really powerful items here that need to be negated or they're going to overshadow everything because they literally can do anything that they want as far as writing stuff right now, because they've got, oh, the stick will handle it. Or if not, we've got the kid over here.
Well, and as you mentioned, kid, she always reminds me of the Star Child from V the miniseries. Maybe it's just a haircut, but, I loved how, I think Nick, as he was negotiating with Renard, was very, I can't say I like, but how he was just cold, and I had a sense he knew what he could get out of Renard and he knew what he couldn't. And so like he got his son and Adeline, but he never even tried for Diana, honestly, because I guess he knew he wasn't going to get it. And it was interesting that pretty much everything he said, Renard pretty much agreed to. So, I liked that in a sense he knew what he could get and asked for exactly that and no more. So I found that sort of negotiations, while obviously quick to write for exposition and for script purposes, at the same time, I thought it played well where, he knew what he wanted and what he could get, and he didn't ask for anything more than Renard would, just agree to and say yes to. That was a very, listen, this is what you're going to give me. Okay. And it was done very sort of businesslike and without much more than that. I thought that was actually maybe not touching, but at the same time, he had his priorities and he got them. So I thought that was good. The whole being stuck in Renard, I felt they played that out just a little too much. It was one thing where oh, we don't know what's going to happen. Oh, we don't know what's going to happen. Oh, look, nothing happened. You're still Renard. We'll look for something.
The
whack.
That, yeah,
oh,
that,
you're back.
That,
yeah.
That was, yeah, that was drawn out. The other side of that that really got to me was the scene between Renard and Adolin where she was trying to keep him from leaving the room and seeing what was going on. Really didn't quite buy that part. She was trying way too hard and was being really suspicious, and it was like they really had to write him as being like dense to not realize something was going on.
Yeah,
and
let's talk about
playing,
my daughter.
Like,
yeah, let's talk
comedy,
about my daughter's school. What?
Yeah.
Do you,
what?
What? Okay.
Like, and like looking really desperate while saying it. It's like, yeah. Oh, sure, that looks like a normal day for you. It's like, what? No,
well,
it was
I never
definitely,
thought of that.
Yeah.
Now, really? At first, I thought she was still trying to keep him away from Hank in the closet. Until I realized that, I remember that they said, oh, make sure he's watching the TV, so.
Yeah.
But
so
yeah.
It just felt like it was way too forced comedy type thing, but I don't know if that was just,
No, I have to admit, I've always had problems with the actress herself.
Hmm.
And I'm not saying I don't agree with you that it was a weak script point, but I've always had a hard time, suspending my disbelief with her as an actress, so.
Hmm. Fair enough. Okay, was there something here on the list that you wanted to bring up?
Yes, I thought that I had an episode that at least I thought knocked it out of the park this week, was the return of Supergirl.
Okay, that would be Supergirl, Season 2, Episode 9, Supergirl Lives, the story of a missing woman named Izzy moves Kara to investigate, even though Snappercar has told her to leave the matter alone. And this one came in actually at an average of 8, and there were a few people that weighed in on this one. Nadim gave it an 8, saying, while it had its moments and some great one-liners, Supergirl Lives falls short when compared to the rest of this stellar season. I think that Henry and I both agreed that there was just something off about this episode. But yeah, you gave this one a pretty high score.
Well, you know, it had a lot of the toys for me. I liked it a lot. I liked, I liked that Alex was happy. That was a nice part. I liked the fact that we had to deal with a non-super powerful Supergirl, and you know, not having any powers and still doing the heroic thing. I liked the little crumb of a tidbit that Dominator let Mon-El go and said something that I don't speak Dominator, so I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it was I take that back. They teletyped some of it where it said, you know, he's important, let him go, or he can't be hurt, something along those lines. And that's a nice little head scratcher right there. We got to see a Stargate for the first time in a long time and watch people travel that way to different worlds. I love the fact that John Jones wasn't able to jump in and help this time because of something wrong in the atmosphere. That was a interesting little twist, but at the same time, I love that it handicapped them. So the little switch of that yellow solar powered bomb to give her back powers for a minute was a nice little MacGuffin as well. I enjoyed it a lot. Also, you know, as a, I guess if you could sort of devolve into the human world of it, you know, we have Kara as a reporter, you know, finally having something that sort of piques her interest and she's going after it, even though Snappercar does not want her to sort of pursue something like that. She went after it anyway, in both personas to try and figure it out. I thought that was really nice in a character development sense that, you know, we've always sort of complained that Kara is a little wishy-washy, at least in the as a human being. And here she's actually starting to show a little, guts again. And then finally, Wynn's development during this whole little episode, even though I feel that they really compressed it. I would have loved to seen his storyline pulled out over a few episodes where he sort of got gun shy about running with Guardian after he was almost killed that time. And it was starting to affect him, his work, where he didn't want to go to that other planet now because he was, you know, traumatized or PTSD perhaps over it. And then having been able to help Supergirl win, he overcame that. I wish that would have actually stretched out for another episode or two to have him deal with it in more than just one episode. I think that would have been of a great help to, you know, many people who do suffer various types of trauma issues.
I thought that was a big part of maybe what my I felt like a lot in this episode. I know that they've got to move through story kind of fast, but I felt like they didn't spend enough time on a lot of things here. I felt like that storyline could have and should have been given more weight. And it actually wound up dominating the episode because they did it all in one episode. They could have done it in more and spread it out a little bit more, and it would have maybe resonated more. Instead, it seemed very easily resolved.
I do agree with you on that. I thought that was definitely a failing of the show that they chose to encapsulate it in one episode.
Yeah, and because of that, I really don't feel like they even had time to do the whole Kara story as well as they could have. This could have been a two-parter, and I think it would have actually worked out better because they rushed things. I don't think that they really had time to delve into the other world or what was on the other side of the gate. That, and oddly enough, this is almost a... This reminded me a lot of the second season opener for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where she was kind of went into kind of like a hell dimension and saved some girl that she met and all this kind of stuff. And it wasn't exactly the same, but it was like, wow, there's a lot of notes that are very similar here. And equally, it was one of those things where it's like, oh, we just kind of go into this other world. We do our quick thing. We do a quick heroic insurrection, and then we're out before anybody can really think about what's going on. And I really felt like even though Mon-El was really had some great moments in this episode, I liked him more than I think I've liked him up to this point. I felt like, again, it's like, spend more time on this. This was way too quickly shuffled out of the way, almost. It was like, let's do this. We'll have a little event episode with all this big, you know, to do with the other episode, with the other world and all that kind of stuff, because it's a Kevin Smith-directed episode. And that was, you know, again, it's like, oh, we're coming back from the hiatus. We have an episode directed by Kevin Smith. And it's like, and it's kind of not that big of a deal.
It did feel a little bit more comic booky. So that I didn't even realize that it was Kevin Smith, but yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
But even there, it's like, no, let him play a little bit more or give the story time to play a little bit more. And I did need to like just say, really, yellow sun grenade. What?
That I like just, the yellow sun. Yeah.
It just didn't fit. It didn't seem to make sense with what we've seen so far from Supergirl. So it was like...
I was a little surprised that her powers dropped so fast. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just like, okay, that's a real plot convenience right there. Again, if they had more time to maybe think it through with a double episode, maybe it could have done something a little bit less crazy. But anyway... So we have that that episode with a lot of diverse opinions. I have to say, there were also some people that are saying that they're kind of, that this whole beating you over the head with all of the social themes they're just not being at all subtle about it. And I do think that there are people that are getting a little bit tired of just how it's being portrayed. I don't think they necessarily have a problem with the plot thing, but it's just like, guys, you don't have to be so heavy-handed. Just let it happen. Let the plots go. Without, like, I'm not even talking about Alex and her relationship at this point. I'm saying the other aspects of the show are just, like, smacking you in the face with it, and it's like, there's better ways to do this. Literally, there are other shows that are covering this in some really interesting ways, and you're being really just a little over the top about things. So... I think that that's also playing into some of the comments from, say, Henry in his review over on VocNetwork.com. Mm-hmm. He got into that a little bit, where it's just not very elegantly written. And again, it's just, you know, oh, did you rush things this time? Is that part of the problem? It's hard to say. Let's see. Was there anything else here on the list that you wanted to, that kind of jumped out at you that you wanted to dig into while we have a little bit of time left?
I am curious. I haven't followed it for maybe about half a season now, but what's going on with Vikings?
Well, Vikings is in an interesting place because right now, you know, I did mention that they are dealing with the fact that they killed off Ragnar, which is at least legendarily accurate.
Yes.
Accurate to the legends, I guess is a better way. So they did that in episode, I think, 16. Of the season. And of course there's 20 episodes to the season. And the 20th episode is going to be a big, massive counter strike against the Britons. So they've spent 3 episodes, or they're spending some episodes getting there. And you definitely feel like they are trying to stretch out the preparation a little bit. And yeah, I guess my comment on this one, because this week's episode was season 4, episode 18, I gave it a 7.5 because it's just kind of, it's a delaying tactic almost. They're really trying hard to make the sons of Ragnar, and there are four of them, as compelling as Ragnar was. But they're literally making the case that you need four characters to add up to one. And it's saying, okay, if that's true, then you didn't flesh out these characters very well, because you should really, what it should be is that you have the benefit of four equally compelling characters instead of just Ragnar. And it's like, no, you've got four people and they don't even add up to him. There's a big hole here that they're still not filling. So yeah, it's fine. I think it's going to work out as far as the big battle is concerned, but man, coming back next year, they are really going to have to think that through. They're going to have to figure out how to make these guys really kind of work on their own instead of simply constantly referring back to Ragnar.
Okay.
I mean, they had to do it. They kind of had to go there. They said they were going to this season. I think that people were expecting it to be the finale, and it wasn't, so it was a little shocking, but yeah, that's where it's at.
Well, that's a big shift for that show. So
Yeah,
let's kill off the main character and keep going.
Basically, I think the part of the problem is that the head writer even said that originally they were going to... They even had Ragnar kind of set up to die the way he does in the Legends back in the first or second season.
Oh.
They set it up that way. And in fact, when you go back, he does have an encounter with the king that ultimately is supposed to have him killed, and in fact does a little bit earlier in the season. But they were going to kill him off and go this whole generational route, but they decided, no, there's a lot more stories to tell with these characters, and I think in a way they should have just gone the way that they originally intended. But certain characters got popular, they really started liking writing for those characters, and they may have shot themselves in the foot in terms of being able to now do it three seasons later.
Mm, yeah, because Ragnar became such a focus of it.
Yes.
Okay. Curious how a Ragnar-less Vikings was going.
The irony of it is that from a seasonal perspective, even though it's had its struggles here in the second half of the season, it's getting the same kind of average that the other ones did. So it's not that it's bad, it's just that they're kind of having a little bit of a struggle here at the very end of the season because of a big plot twist that they put in. They've got to pay it off, and I think they're not quite doing it yet. All right, I think that just about brings us up to speed here for this week. Next week, we will once again have some big topics for us to discuss. I'm sure that the genre news will be more than happy to provide us with lots to discuss, and we will have even more episodes to pick from next time. So, Gary, any last thoughts for this week?
I'm glad the level of quality has gone up this week, and I hope it continues.
Yes, I hope so, too. And, for me, the last thought here is as I look at the next week's run of episodes here, we have a few shows coming to a seasonal or an even series end. Salem comes to its series finale next time. We have The Magicians coming back for its second season. We have Incorporated ending its first season. We have the premiere of Riverdale. We have, what else is on this list? We have The Return of Black Sails. And, yeah, those are all some big things happening next time. So, and we have just a whole slew of our normal episodes to pick and choose from. So, who knows which ones are going to end up at the bottom and which ones will end up at the top. We'll see you next week. Until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.